This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The word feminist is a heavy one with history and implication and judgment. It's been seen as positive and negative. Arguments abound over who's really a feminist and who's not, what it means to be a feminist and what it doesn't. Exploring the meaning of the word feminism, the basis of feminist theory, and its application to real life is my guest, Sara Ahmed. She's a feminist writer, scholar, and activist, and the author of Willful Subjects, On Being Included, The Promise of Happiness and Queer Phenomenology. Her latest book is called simply Living a Feminist Life, which has received a serious stamp of approval from none other than Bell Hooks, who said everyone should read this book. I'm so pleased to be joined by Sara Ahmed. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Can you begin by just reading for our audience the first paragraph of your book? Because I feel like that sets the stage for what you write about.
Yes, I'd be really pleased to do so. What do you hear when you hear the word feminism? It is a word that fills me with hope, with energy. It brings to mind loud acts of refusal and rebellion, as well as the quiet ways we might have of not holding on to things that diminish us. It brings to mind women who have stood up, spoken back, risked lives, home, relationships, in the struggle for more bearable worlds. It brings to mind books written, tattered and worn, books that gave words to something, a feeling, a sense of injustice, books that, in giving us words, gave us the strength to go on. Feminism, how we pick each other up. So much history in a word, so much it too has picked up.
Sara Ahmed reading the first paragraph of her book, Living a Feminist Life. Well, as your paragraph suggested so much more eloquently than I could, the word feminist and feminism, it's a heavy one because there's a sector of our society that feels incredibly threatened by it. What makes one a feminist? What makes you a feminist? I mean, it's a label that I feel like I, you know, have from the time that I discovered it, have espoused it and used it proudly as a label for myself. But what makes you a feminist?
I think we hear different things when we hear the word feminism. I mean, that in a way was my starting point. But for me, feminism does bring to mind a certain way of being in the world, a willingness to challenge social norms and conventions, a willingness to risk security and safety in a fight for a world that is more bearable. And I think if you hear in that word a kind of electricity, if you hear in that word a courage to keep going, to keep challenging, then that makes you a feminist. You become part of a feminist history. You receive that history willingly. And I feel that it doesn't necessarily prescribe a particular set of actions, but it is a kind of attitude and a will to fight and to live in a way that is expressive of the values that you have. Those values might be about equality or justice, but they matter to you in everything you do. If you're a feminist, you're a feminist everywhere, in every place.
When we hear the term feminist theory, I have to absolutely confess my eyes glaze over, okay? Because we do have a lot of works that cite feminist theory, that say they're feminist theory, that sound so theoretical and so abstract that they don't seem relatable, that they don't seem to be applicable to real life. Was that one of the issues that you attempted to address in your book?
Yeah, I think so. I think when we hear the word feminist theory, for a lot of us, whether we're at university or not, the word theory itself becomes somewhat excluding. Like, I don't belong there. It references a body of work that's not at home for me. And I'm very aware of that, the politics around theory and the politics of academic language. I'm at home there because I've been trained. I've been there a lot of my life. I'm used to it. I'm familiar with it. But not everyone feels like that. And I think people like academics and activists like Bell Hooks, Angela Davis, they've been really important because they brought theory, which appears over there, back here, back home, so that it becomes more accessible. It becomes something that you can claim as your own. And in the book, I've often done quite theoretical work and the figure of the feminist killjoy, which is one of my primary figures. I first introduced her in a very theoretical book called The Promise of Happiness, which was about the history of happiness. But here I wanted to pull that figure out, that figure who's really a connecting device for feminists, and put her into everyday life and do feminist theory through her, quite ordinary situations of being a feminist and being the one who causes the unhappiness of others. These are situations we can relate to. Well, they're theoretically interesting. I mean, that was one of my starting points. They're theoretically interesting places. The actual experience of being a feminist, living a feminist life and doing a feminist at work, that's where theory happens.
Now, you say feminism is homework in your book. I mean, this, and you said earlier that, you know, this is, you have to be a feminist in all aspects of your life. But what does that exactly mean? I mean, does it mean when, you know, if you have children, does being a mother, but does it mean doing housework? Does it mean being a feminist in your day-to-day work? If so, how does that actually appear? How does that actually manifest itself?
I think that's up to the person who identifies with the word feminism to work out how and where feminism manifests in their life. But for me, I mean, living a feminist life is to make a life a question of how to live as well as we can in a world that doesn't reflect or embody feminist principles. So being a feminist is actually often living with anti-feminism. It's living with the constant understanding of feminism as a threat to life, as a threat to happiness, as a threat to who it is that we are. So when I say sort of being a feminist everywhere, I really mean asking all the time about how to live or what I'm doing. Is what I'm doing expressive of the feminist values that I have? It doesn't necessarily get you into a particular relationship to housework. It just makes you think about housework, about the politics of housework, who does the housework, how we can distribute housework in a way that is more equal. It gets you to think about feminism as not just a tool you can pick up at a certain point, but as a tool, what you carry with you. You almost become a feminist tool, like a hammer. You know, you are chipping away at those walls, those institutions that are not just out there in the world over there, but they're here, they're at home, they're where we live, they're where we work.
Right.
So for me, that's what I mean to say. When I say being a feminist everywhere, I mean always thinking with a kind of reflexive attitude about what it is that you're doing and how it is that you're being in the world with others.
When you operate as a feminist or apply feminist values to the home, it becomes very personal, right? Because suddenly you're negotiating with often your intimate partner, whether or not that partner is male or female. I'm sure those same issues arise. And when you're applying them in the workplace, they also become different. Sometimes they become an institutional issue. But all of those things do originate with the individual that identifies themselves as feminist. Is there a problem with demanding results right away? Because this is, you know, it becomes really difficult to have that constant battle. It feels like being constantly on the front lines of a battle that sometimes you win, sometimes you don't, and you don't always see progress, if you will, personally or institutionally.
I think there are many that might say that being a feminist and being committed to feminism is about making your life more difficult than it needs to be. I've often heard that expression take the form of kindness. You know, why are you making it so hard for yourself? Just sort of settle down, give up, give in. For me, actually, once you become a feminist and you're kind of switched on, you're aware of the politics around you, you're aware of how inequality often gets reproduced by not coming into view, it is actually very hard to turn it off. Which actually means that sometimes even feminists need break from doing the work of feminism, time for to recharge your batteries so that you can come back and take up the fight again. So it is difficult. It is difficult to be attuned to the very inequalities that you're fighting against all the time, to watch a film, turn it on, turn on the social media, and there it is, something else. And you have to be quite careful not to become too knowing and too expectant, that everything you encounter becomes a confirmation of what you already know. There has to be an element of surprise and a kind of a will to uncover what you don't always understand in the first instance. But I do think that, however difficult, being a feminist has given me so much in my life, because it is about questioning things. It isn't about taking things for granted. You don't assume that a life has to take this shape or have this form to count as a good life, you're really opening the world up. And so with the difficulty comes excitement and opportunity, in a sense that with others, you can actually rebuild worlds. Not now necessarily that the world is going to reflect your values, but that you can actually find ways of developing relationships that are more attuned to the values that you have. And I think that that feels like you're involved in a project of world creation, which is why I called the Feminist Killjoy a world-making project.
And let's talk about that, Feminist Killjoy. Killjoy, it sounds terrible. Where does that come from? Why Killjoy?
Well, it's a stereotype of feminists, without any question, that they are partly always against things because that they have, there's an implication that feminists kill joy because they are joyless. Because really what they are expressing is a will to power. They are angry and frustrated because the world doesn't accommodate their needs and desires. So the figure of the feminist killjoy begins as an anti-feminist figure. And what we're doing is we're reclaiming her. We're saying, okay, if it kills joy to point out sexism, if it kills joy to point out racism, then I'm going to kill joy. You're actually claiming the negation that is directed toward you in order to build a world otherwise. But it's hard to kill joy, and it's hard. Those experiences that I had growing up, say, being a killjoy at the family table, or those experiences at university or being a killjoy at the meeting table, they're difficult. And so when we're talking about killing joy's world making, we're trying to find ways of supporting the process, the politics of killing joy, so that you don't feel that you're cutting yourself off from others, that you feel that there are others who recognize in the situation that you're in something that they too have been in. And I was really amazed when I first began talking about killjoys. It was quite a while ago. It would have been 2008, 2009, in writing about happiness. How even though the killjoy is about something difficult and painful, even though it's an anti-feminist trope in the first instance, as soon as I started talking about her, the atmosphere would change. People would become quite electric. The killjoy, yes, they sense in those eyes rolling when she says something, something that they too, a place that they too had been in. And so actually the killjoy, even though she signals something painful and difficult, is also about reclaiming that history and finding in the negation something quite powerful, something that's full of potential.
So it's a negative stereotype. In that stereotype, of course, there have been legions of anti-feminists, men, the so-called men's rights movement, that have taken great glee in using it to undercut the most basic of women's rights. I mean, here in the United States, we see that over and over again. We see this ugly term feminazi that's often used by some conservative writers, so-called conservative writers. And the attacks are so vicious against this stereotype of feminist that it can really cow people into silence, right? I mean, this is a huge problem. I think it's also one reason why so many young women, up until maybe recently, had shied away from calling themselves feminist and had seen in a way, giving into sexist versions of themselves as a feminist act. And that's a kind of a field mired in controversy.
It is a field mired in controversy. And I think the figure of the killjoy, that specific figure, picks that up. She picks up controversy. She names a controversy. And I think that when we're sort of talking about kind of anti-feminism, we're also talking about, I mean, I think about it in terms of winding up. You know, when somebody knows that you're a feminist, they know what buttons to press. They actually want you to be provoked. They want you to display the reaction that they can then say is a confirmation of you being
unreasonable. Oh, yes. I've come across many men in my lifetime who have done that.
Exactly. We recognize that it's something vicious in that cycle. And when you do get wound up by somebody who's winding you up, there is that kind of confirmation, oh, look at her, see, a kind of judgment that finds you. So but I don't think the answer to that difficult dynamic is to withdraw from it. I think what we do need to understand is the cost of it. The cost of doing the work is very, very high, not just of being a killjoy, but of being a feminist. Because actually, I think one of the things that I've really learned about being a feminist is to understand how it is that many people don't become feminists. Because actually, to not go along with things, to name problems, to be willing to point it out, you do get ostracized, you do get cut off, and you are made to pay. And I think people are aware of that. They're aware that, because that's actually, that's how power works. power works by making it hard to challenge power. It's not going to be easy. And I think in a way, I mean, I've been very aware working around the question of sexual harassment in universities recently, that it works like this, that not being willing to go along with it, to name it as a problem, is to become the problem. Yeah. And we all know that becoming a problem, that's not just about semantics, that's not just about being judged in a certain way. It can actually literally mean being cut off from support systems, from all the means by which people are rewarded and enabled within institutions. So feminism has to be about sharing the costs of doing that work. And it also has to be about supporting those who do that work, so that if a student, for example, does identify sexual harassment as something that's affected her life and her progression, then that student is supported by other feminists in the institution and enabled to have the very career that she's threatened not to have by naming something.
Yeah.
And that involves a lot of politics, that involves a lot of work. And that's also what being a killjoy is about. It's supporting those who actually are willing to point out the problems without becoming the solutions.
Absolutely. There's a lot of nefarious outcomes when one does speak up. We see this women facing this time and again. There's also the issue of who is a feminist. And sometimes we have women who identify themselves as feminist doing, there's this tendency to want to aim for purity. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this. I mean, during the Women's March here in the United States, there was a group of women that said that they felt excluded because of Palestinian rights activists, that they could be Zionist and feminist. There was even a group of women that said that they were anti-abortion feminists. Then you have people who say, you know, well, Beyonce is not really a feminist, even though she calls herself a feminist. And now Chimamanda Adichie, the famous Nigerian feminist, has had her credentials called into question because of statements she made that have been construed as anti-transgender. So what are your thoughts on this identification of the term feminist and sometimes our use of that label to negate one another?
This is a very difficult history, and it's a long history within feminism of conflict about who gets to be a feminist. And also not just that, because it's not just about personal identification, whose experiences, whose aspirations get to be the ones that shape the broader feminist community. I mean, the history of Black feminism and feminism of colour has been to point out how so much feminism generalised from the aspirations, hopes and life experiences of white women. And pointing out that exclusion, that wasn't really about who gets to be a feminist or not. That was just pointing out how feminism reproduces the privileges of those who come to it. And we need not to do that. We need actually to open feminism up so that actually those who have to struggle to be at the feminist table, who aren't seen as women in the same way or aren't seen as central in the same way, those struggles become the ones that we take up as foundational, fundamental, and important to feminist work. Otherwise, feminism becomes another means of reproducing social privilege, because the most privileged women who can speak the loudest or have the most authority behind them because of class, because of race, because of gender, sexuality, will be the ones that actually end up being how feminism is taken up, and we can't afford that. Hmm. So I think of it less as who gets to be a feminist, but more as in how can feminist community be shaped by those who have to struggle to be. Because it's the struggle to be in the world a woman, the struggle to be a woman, the struggle to be a person. These are the struggles that actually change the structures that decide what it means to be in the world.
Women of color have the greater struggle. So certainly there are ways in which one can identify those with the least privilege have the greatest struggle left to deal with. And want to end finally, Sara, with asking you to explain the last couple of parts of your book. You have a Killjoy Survival Kit and a Killjoy Manifesto. What are these?
Well, I wanted two conclusions, and I started with the survival kit, because partly I think before you can get to a manifesto, like a sense of a program for change, you actually need to be there, you need to survive. And when I use survival, I'm very influenced by Audre Lorde, her incredible work, which made survival into a politics, because as she put it so poetically, so politically, there are some of us that weren't meant to survive. So then survival becomes about caring for yourself, enabling yourself to keep going. And we can think of keep going here, not just in terms of living, but also keeping one's projects alive. Like, what do we need to do to enable us to keep going when the consequences of the work can be so wearing? So for feminism to survive, feminists need to survive. And I think we have each other to draw upon. We have skills and resources, we have knowledge, we have capacities because of what we've come up against. And they go into my survival kit, which is full of books, because that's the kind of feminist I am, including books by bell hooks and Audre Lorde and Judith Butler, whose books for me were essential to my own survival as a feminist in an institution that was difficult to be in. So the manifesto, there's such a wonderful history of feminist manifestos, and I love the genre. I love the idea that through writing, we also make manifest not only a critique of what is, but a vision of what could be. So for me, a feminist killjoy manifesto is fundamentally tied to critique, because the killjoy herself, it's a violent figure. Kill means kill joy. It's almost murderous. And the reason the killjoy is so violent is because she exposes violence. When you expose violence, you often become seen as the cause of the violence you expose. You almost appear violent because you bring that violence to the surface. So a killjoy manifesto is trying to think about what we need to do to keep doing the work of making the violences of the social order, gender violence, racial violence, manifest, of keeping going and doing that work. And it involves a series of principles about what we need to be willing to do in order to keep exposing the violence of the institutions that make it very difficult to be in the world for so many.
Well, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for the work you've done. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest is Sarah Ahmed. She's a feminist writer, scholar, and activist, the author of Willful Subjects on Being Included, The Promise of Happiness, and Queer Phenomenology. We've been talking about her newest book, Living a Feminist Life. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at Rising Up with Sonali, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.